terror strikes a southern town.
These women were savagely beaten, strangled with a stocking, and raped.
It was unheard of.
What made it all the more horrifying was that it was a serial killer.
Dubbed the Stocking Strangler, the killer strikes at will.
The police seem so powerless.
When a suspect is finally tracked down.
He was a pimp. He was a professional burglar. He was a puzzle.
He's convicted and sentenced to die. It all seems open and shut.
I think they got the right guy.
Or did they? In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Contributing editor David Rose unearths Seeds of Doubt. People of Columbus, Georgia, like to think of their town as friendly and safe. But everyone remembers the day the nightmare began.
A lady who was very influential, Fern Jackson, she doesn't show up for work.
Fern Jackson was a health department official, and she was deeply loved.
Someone goes around to her house and finds this appalling scene.
She was found on her bed, and she was beaten on the left side of the face. She was strangled with a stocking, and she had been sexually assaulted, raped.
Fern Jackson's house is ransacked, but no valuables are missing. The brutal killing sends shockwaves through Columbus, Georgia's second largest city, still grappling with a history of racial tension.
People here are going to hate me for saying this, but it was a racist community to begin with, and it has a violent history. But it was unheard of for a respected elderly white woman to be sexually assaulted and killed. And so that got everybody's attention.
In the late 1970s, senseless murders are on everyone's mind. Just 1 month earlier, New York police arrested David Berkowitz, the infamous Son of Sam killer. Berkowitz had terrorized the city for a year, stalking and shooting innocent young women.
This is the man police say is the .44 caliber killer. He had a faint smile as police moved him around the city today.
The FBI recently coined a new phrase to describe psychopaths like Berkowitz. Serial killers. Things like that just didn't happen in the neighborhood where Fern Jackson lives. Winton is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Columbus, home to wealthy families before the Civil War.
It's an upscale neighborhood. There are beautiful antebellum homes there.
Then, 9 days later, in the same Winton neighborhood, Gene Diamondstein, 71, owner of a small department store, is found strangled in her bed.
Gene Diamondstein, who lived right up the street from Fern, was assaulted brutally and killed.
These two women were savagely beaten on the left side of their face. They were strangled with a stocking, and they both were raped.
The first murder of Fern Jackson was a horrifying event in Columbus. But what made it all the more horrifying was that there was another killing, quite clearly by the same individual, the same modus operandi. It was now clear that there was a serial killer.
The media dubbed Columbus's serial killer the Stocking Strangler. And the police announce they have arrested a suspect, Jerome Livas.
They had a man called Jerome Livas in custody, who had not only confessed to murdering his then partner, but also to the murders of Mrs. Diemenstein and Mrs. Jackson. And this was a fantastic coup. The city can breathe again.
Detective Mike Sellers remembers driving through Winton and passing the home of a friend's grandmother, noticing how frail she was.
Mrs. Scheibel, she was 89 years old and legally blind, and she was on a walker, and she was in her front yard, and I saw her picking up magnolia leaves and putting them in a basket.
Then, just days later, with Jerome Livas behind bars, Florence Scheibel is found murdered, exactly like the others.
One of the other things that this murderer would do, before he left the victim's body there, all the victims' faces were covered up, either with a pillow or the bedspread, so that when you went into the homes, that you did not see them until you pulled the covers back or removed the pillow from the victim.
If Jerome Livas is the stalking strangler, then who murdered Florence Scheibel? Police assume it must be a copycat killer. But then a newspaper reporter interviews Livas, and the police's main suspect confesses to murdering Presidents Kennedy and McKinley.
Jerome Livas proceeded to confess to every killing since the Garden of Eden. So it became a laughing stock.
Murders continued to occur, and so it was obvious that it wasn't him.
With the real stalking strangler still on the loose, investigators flood into Winton.
They began to put more police officers in uniform in the Winton area, especially at night, to patrol the area for anyone that was walking in the area, to stop them and ID them.
It wasn't even confined just to the police. There were state troopers. There were soldiers from Fort Benning, the huge military base, which is right next door to Columbus.
But just 4 days after Florence Scheibel's murder, and despite the massive police presence, Martha Thurman, a 69-year-old schoolteacher, becomes the stalking strangler's fourth victim.
The community reacted in various ways, from panic to fear to anger, and the police weren't immune. It was not a police department prepared for such a case.
They had no leads, they had nothing. There was a growing sense of horror and outrage and anger that the police seemed so powerless to do anything about these crimes.
The town froze in fear. People were leaving lights on all night. People were spending the night with relatives. People were getting with their neighbors and attaching panic buttons.
Police go door to door to identify possible victims, elderly single white women. Young officers are assigned to guard them after dark.
So we virtually went in and sat in the dark while these ladies slept, hoping that the killer would attempt to break in the house.
December 28th, 1977, sometime after midnight, the strangler assaults and kills 74-year-old Kathleen Woodruff.
She was strangled with a scarf that was, if I remember correctly, a University of Georgia emblem scarf. The city was virtually going nuts.
Shortly, they formed a task force, and they put some of the best police they had on it. The undercover agents were everywhere.
Weeks pass without an attack. Then, in one night, the strangler strikes with a boldness that shocks everyone.
It was a night in February 1978. It's still known as the Night of the Terrors, where a lady was woken up being attacked by the strangler, and she pressed a panic button.
74-year-old Ruth Schwob, who is trained in judo, manages to fight off her masked attacker.
And the killer ran away. Now, Within minutes, the whole place was surrounded by law enforcement vehicles. What does the killer do? He quietly climbs into another woman's house, rapes her and murders her, and slinks away completely undetected.
The body of Mildred Borum, 78, is found later that day by police.
She had been strangled with the Venetian blind cord that had been ripped down from her window. That was number 6.
For a time, the killings stop. Some speculate that the strangler has moved on, scared off by the massive law enforcement operation.
Unfortunately, there was a number 7. This was the very first case that did not occur directly in the Winton neighborhoods. This one occurred on a street called Steam Mill Road, and this was probably 5 miles from the Winton neighborhood. The lady's name was Janet Cofer.
The killer treated Janet Cofer in the way that he had the others. He raped and strangled her, but he also bit her savagely on her breast, and he left a deep bite wound.
Imagine the fear that overtook the city at that time, that now he's not just on this 1-2 mile neighborhood area, now he's going out in the city other places. So it became frantic.
Columbus awaits the next victim. No one doubts now that the stalking strangler could strike anywhere. Over a period of 8 months, 7 elderly women have been beaten, raped, and strangled to death in Columbus, Georgia.
Nobody was in custody. There were no plausible suspects for these crimes.
Searching for any clue, the task force investigating the serial killings begins to look at burglaries that occurred around the time of the murders.
The police became obsessed that any crime in the Winton area committed during the time of the stranglings must be the work of the strangler.
The thought was, between those detectives and the rest of us, that no one in their right mind would burglarize a house in Winton with all the police out there crawling everywhere unless they were the killer.
Less than a month after the first murder, an intruder enters the home of 2 elderly sisters, Callie East and Nellie Sanderson. Fortunately, that night, Nellie Sanderson's son Henry and his wife are visiting for a few days.
This burglar, if you will, looked in their room, then went to the other bedroom and opened the door and found Mr. Sanderson and his wife asleep.
When Henry wakes up the next morning, his car is missing. The police find the vehicle a few days later. The gun Sanderson kept in the glove compartment is gone.
Mr. Sanderson had a Ruger .22 caliber pistol in the glove box of his car, and that pistol was taken.
Police speculate that the thief intended to attack the elderly women and was only deterred by Henry Sanderson's presence. They suspect that the man who stole Sanderson's car is the stalking strangler. If they can locate the missing gun, police believe they'll find the killer.
They had a picture of the stolen weapon on the front page of the paper, and they became convinced that this would help them track the strangler.
We never got any useful response from that gun being displayed that I remembered, so that was a dead end.
It has been a year and a half since the first murder. The task force has spent more than $1 million and questioned 16,000 people. All of their leads are exhausted.
The task force was essentially wound down and became a much smaller unit, just a handful of people.
We, as police officers, felt like that this person was either deceased or he was in prison somewhere. But we always kept a hope that we would be able to clear this.
Nearly 6 years pass when Henry Sanderson calls the police. He wants to know if his stolen gun was ever found.
My ex-partner, Detective Wiggins, came to me and said, "Hey, I've got this guy. He says something about a Ruger 22. I said, "That's the gun that we were thinking may have been stolen by the Strangler." So I went downstairs to our record division, and I had the young lady send a teletype nationwide to all police departments.
This time, they get a hit.
Amazingly, I got one response on the gun, and it was from the firearms division of the Michigan State Police in East Lansing, Michigan.
The 22 caliber Ruger is registered in Kalamazoo, Michigan, to a man named Aaron Sanders. The gun originally belonged to his cousin, Carlton Gary. It's the first time Detective Mike Sellers has ever heard the name, but he'll soon discover that Gary has a connection to Columbus, Georgia.
Carlton Gary was partly raised in Columbus by two aunts. His father left home when Carlton was very young. People in Columbus remember when his mother sent him out on the street when he was 6 years old to dig food out of garbage cans. He had a brutal upbringing. If there ever was a child who was, from the get-go, tossed on the refuse heap, it was Carlton Gary. His juvenile record is this long. I'm not exaggerating. Amazing document.
Arrested early. He was a pimp. He was a professional burglar who had been charged multiple times in multiple cities and states. He was a puzzle.
Could police have just stumbled onto the stalking strangler?
He was not invisible. He didn't hide. He modeled clothes, for God's sakes, for a black clothing store downtown.
They did commercials on there. Suits, and in return for a wardrobe, Carlton would be in their TV ads.
Police have no idea that the man appearing in TV ads every night is a career criminal. At the local clubs, Carlton Gary is a magnet for women.
He dated all these Columbus women who just fell for him. He had women everywhere, lots of women.
I had great difficulty in trying to equate this guy who had lovely girlfriends, who had clearly very normal sexual relationships with young black women, with this horrendous, crazed killer.
In 1984, when police cross-reference Gary's fingerprints with those found at the crime scenes, they find a match.
I took the prints downstairs to our ID technicians, and I said, "Please check that print from Miss Woodruff's screen." He said, "It matches." There was no doubt, this is it. This is him.
But when the police try to track down Gary, he's no longer in Columbus. An intense statewide manhunt begins.
About 5 o'clock in the afternoon on May the 3rd, we got a call that the Albany, Georgia Police Department had located him. Their SWAT team had arrested him for us.
The media is waiting when the Columbus police return with the man they say is the stalking strangler.
He was like a rock star coming down that hall. He was just checking everybody out. And cameras were rolling, flashes, strobes. And he wasn't fazed in the least.
We brought Carlton Gary into the detective office. He said he wanted to get straight with us. And he said, I was in those houses, but I wasn't alone. I burglarized the houses, and somebody else killed the old ladies. And we said, if you didn't kill the ladies, who did?
Columbus police have Carlton Gary in custody, the man they believe is the stalking strangler. But Gary swears he hasn't killed anyone.
And we said, if you didn't kill the ladies, who did? And he said, a friend of mine, his name is Malvin Alamichael Crittenden.
I was there with this other guy, Crittenden. I saw what happened, I saw what he did. He went into these houses and he committed the crimes and I didn't.
Crittenden's prints are tested. They don't match any found at the crime scenes. Police rule him out as a suspect. But when 70-year-old Columbus resident Gertrude Miller sees Carlton Gary's arrest on the TV news, she says she recognizes him right away.
She was a person who lived just outside of the imaginary lines of Winton, in a neighborhood very close to where Carlton Gary grew up.
She's this very well-educated Catholic woman who'd worked in civil rights in Mississippi in the 1930s and who had run a integrated nursery for black children for 30 or 40 years.
On the night of September 11th, 1977, 5 days before the stalking strangler's first murder, an intruder breaks into Gertrude Miller's home and viciously attacks her.
He beat her on the left side of the face. He strangled her and sexually assaulted her and left thinking that she had died from asphyxiation from strangulation, but she survived.
When police question Gertrude Miller after the assault, she is unable to identify her attacker until more than 6 years later, she sees Carlton Gary on her living room television.
She was sitting with her daughter watching TV and she said, that's him.
The evidence against Carlton Gary seems crystal clear.
They've got fingerprints. They have, most compellingly, the testimony of Gertrude Miller.
He was indicted by a grand jury of three of the killings of these women. The afternoon paper hit the streets and the story began to circulate. There was a true feeling of relief.
Carlton Gary asks attorney Bud Seaman from Atlanta, a seasoned death penalty lawyer, to defend him. Seaman agrees to work pro bono.
I thought the world of Bud Seaman and some of the early attorneys. Bud had high moral motivations.
His problem was that he wasn't paid to be Carlton's trial lawyer. The court just refused time and again to give him any money for experts, for witness expenses, for any of the costs that you would, of course, incur in trying to defend a case like this.
The court completely denied them any assistance whatsoever. Today, this would just be considered outrageous.
The trial judge refuses to provide any funds for Carlton Gary's defense. Many judges and lawyers agree that the only way to assure a fair trial is to provide indigent defendants the resources they need. Carlton Gary goes on trial for the murders of Florence Scheibel, Martha Thurman, and Kathleen Woodruff before a jury of 9 white and 3 black citizens from a neighboring county.
The prosecutor only brought charges against Carlton on the women that he knew he had fingerprints from.
The prosecution calls 139 witnesses during the 3-week trial. The judge allows the district attorney to introduce evidence from all seven killings, which is legal under Georgia law. It is a powerful case.
The prosecution was trying to suggest that Carlton Gary had been this driven sexual predator. From 1970 onwards, he had had this fiendish, murderous interest in elderly women.
So the prosecution had all the resources of the Georgia Crime Lab and other experts that they could bring into the case, but the defense was not allowed to have any funds. His defense was defenseless. He had a single lawyer without any funds, without any resources to assist him.
The verdict came quickly.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of the murder of Florence Kerr Scheibel, count one, indictment 48573.
Guilty of three slangs, murders. The sentencing came quickly, execution. At the time, that would have been in Georgia's electric chair.
It is further ordered and adjudged by the court that the defendant, Carlton Gary, shall be executed.
The people of Columbus celebrate the verdict. But Carlton Gary insists that he's not guilty.
He believed that he had not had a fair trial and that he was innocent.
Year after year, a series of lawyers petition the court for a new trial. After 10 years on death row, Carlton Gary's defense team finds a new ally, British investigative reporter David Rose.
It was the summer of 1996, 20 years ago. I headed down to Columbus to look at the way the death penalty was working there. And you don't have to be in Columbus, Georgia for very long until you hear the name Carlton Gary and about the stocking stranglings case. I thought this was a case that merited further attention, and some very strange things had happened at his trial. There was evidence, even at that early stage, which suggested that, you know, he may well have been wrongfully convicted, that he was in fact innocent of these crimes.
He has the way of getting people to talk to him. At some point I said, listen, David, you're helping us so much. Why don't we make you an investigator in the case? Because you're doing it already.
Rose begins speaking with members of the original task force who worked on the 20-year-old case. Most of them tell Rose that Carlton Gary got what he deserved. But one man isn't so sure.
A GBI agent came to us who had been part of the task force, and he said there was a footprint at one of the entries of one of the crimes.
He had photographed this footprint, he'd measured it, and it was a size 9 sneaker. It was quite clear that this must have belonged to the killer. Carlton Gary has size 13 and a half, size 14 feet. In his view, it was one of the most critical pieces of physical evidence. It was totally hidden from Carlton Gary's trial.
Equally troubling, a mysterious cast of the strangler's teeth made from the bite mark on the breast of Janet Kofer, the killer's final victim. The existence of the bite cast was withheld from the original defense team.
Where was this cast? Nobody had any idea. It had apparently been disappeared.
Then, in 2005, thanks to pressure from Carlton Gary's lawyers, the missing evidence is located.
The new coroner found the bite mark mold that had been lost for years. Physical evidence. Evidence that we're not talking about whether some witness is changing their story. This is physical evidence that doesn't lie.
Carlton Gary's teeth are unusually clean and even and straight. The stocking strangler had teeth that were out of alignment with wide gaps. Carlton Gary's teeth do not match those of the person who bit the breast of Janet Kofer.
Could Carlton Gary be an innocent man? Vanity Fair writer David Rose is convinced that, guilty or innocent, Carlton Gary did not get a fair trial. The story gets more complicated when Rose learns about another murder in upstate New York.
The first time I heard the name Marion Fisher, I was assigned to the Cold Case Task Force for the Syracuse Police Department. And Marion Fisher's file was one of the first cases that we reviewed. She was a physical education teacher, totally innocent victim that was murdered.
Best of my recollection, she had her husband, John, and two children, a boy and a girl. I think Marion was 40 at the time of her death.
The body was discovered by two pre-teenage boys who were actually riding their bicycles down Lafayette Road. They observed the body just off on the side of the road beyond a hedgerow. She had been strangled and she had been sexually abused.
Marion Fisher's body is found 3.5 miles away from the bar where she had been seen the night before.
Marion Fisher and her husband had been out the previous night at a place called The Barge, and they had a couple of drinks there. And at that point, Marion and her husband, John, got in an argument, and Marion left the bar never to be seen again. According to Mr. Fisher, when he woke up the next morning, he had heard that a body was discovered, and he called the police department, worried that it may be his wife. John Fisher became the prime suspect in the case.
The alibi kind of fell apart. He said that he was home all night, and yet three kids in the neighborhood all swore that he left the house that night. And then probably the final things was he failed a polygraph. But based on the evidence available to him, the then district attorney did not authorize charges to be brought against Mr. Fisher. It goes unsolved. It was as cold as a case could get.
In August 2007, after Lieutenant Rockwood reopens Marion Fisher's cold case, he meets with John Fisher to get a sample of his DNA. Rockwood wants to compare it to the semen recovered from Marion Fisher's body 30 years earlier, when DNA tests were not possible.
He was very cooperative. He offered up his DNA and said he was happy to help in any way he could. A couple of months later, after submitting the sample to the Forensic Crime Center, results came back that he, in fact, was not the donor of that DNA.
Good grief. The criminal justice system has put a cloud of suspicion over a guy for 30 years that is not only not guilty, he is 100% factually innocent.
Lieutenant Rockwood then requests that the crime lab check a red towel found near Marion Fisher's body for DNA.
They were able to submit that complete DNA profile to the National Data Bank for identification purposes.
And we came back with an exact match to Carlton Gary, who is the stocking strangler from Georgia.
Lieutenant Rockwood heads to Georgia's death row to question Carlton Gary about Marion Fisher. Gary admits that he was in Syracuse at the time working for a local fencing company.
At first, Carlton said, he goes, I don't recall anything. And then I said, Carlton, you know what DNA is, right? He was well-versed on DNA and understood it completely. He said, I was at a bar. He met a lady there that was intoxicated or high or something, and that she had just had a fight with her boyfriend or husband or something. He ended up having sexual intercourse with the victim on the hood of a car in the back of the parking lot. He goes, when I got done, I went back in the bar and that was it, and I don't know where she went.
And he portrayed it as a consensual encounter, which doesn't pass the laugh test. And then someone else just happens to come along later and strangle her. Now my question as a prosecutor is, well, what do I do about Carlton Gary? He's on death row.
Syracuse District Attorney William Fitzpatrick decides not to prosecute Gary, since he is already awaiting execution in Georgia.
Carlton saw these cops. He talked to them. He didn't have any attorney present. Nobody's ever seen any documents that attest to the validity of these tests or otherwise. But it certainly helped to create the impression that he was a really bad guy.
I've never investigated that case. It never was presented properly in court. It's a claim that has been made, but never proven.
There's no doubt in my mind that Carlton Gary is guilty of this homicide.
To Gary's legal team, the Syracuse allegations are unsubstantiated and have nothing to do with his Georgia case. Their priority is preventing Carlton Gary's impending execution.
Carlton Gary was on the fast track to execution. He lost all his appeals. The Supreme Court wouldn't review the case. He'd been denied clemency. And so the execution date was set for, I think it was 7 o'clock in the evening on December the 9th, 2009. And the hours were ticking away. He couldn't get a stay.
Desperate to find new evidence, Rose uncovers a lead. A retired Columbus police officer admits that slides of semen samples taken from the victims still exist. The defense was told all of the samples had been destroyed years earlier.
They bring out this box and they put it on the table and we opened the box and then I realized what they were. I knew we had the key piece of evidence.
But despite the newfound evidence, no court will postpone Carlton Gary's scheduled execution.
Here was this extraordinary evidence on top of all the other evidence that had been hidden all these years. And nobody would give Carlton the stay. I thought that was it. I woke up the next morning, Carlton was going to be dead.
But the case of the stalking strangler will take one more unexpected turn.
So it came to the day of his execution.
It was right before Christmas. And I am down there at the prison talking to Carlton for the last time.
He had said goodbye to his family. They had already prepared him for execution.
We were driving and I looked at my watch and I told my wife, I said, Carlton Gary is about to be executed.
My cell phone rang, and it was actually Michael McIntyre, Jack's colleague, saying, we got a stay of execution. It's incredible. You know, Carl isn't going to die tonight.
The Georgia Supreme Court had stayed the execution and was allowing the DNA evidence to go forward.
Saying that the items that had been found in the Columbus Police Department from the crime scenes had to be DNA tested to see if they matched Carlton Gary.
And we had them sent to the GBI crime lab to test for DNA. This is what can tell us once and for all whether Carlton Gary is guilty.
There were samples from three victims, two of whom Gary was convicted of killing, Martha Thurman and Kathleen Woodruff, and another he was suspected of killing, Jean Diamonstein. Gary was never charged with her murder.
The most important result initially appeared to be completely sensational. He did not match the semen left on Martha Thurman's body.
The Woodruff sample turns out to be inconclusive. But the Diamonstein sample tells a different story.
In the Diamonstein case, one of the samples we sent to the GBI crime lab to test. And they came back and said, well, that matches Carlton Gary's DNA.
Well, they say that this shows that Carlton Gary was actually the killer. He was never charged with Jean Diamonstein's murder.
Given the contradictory DNA results, the defense searches for more physical evidence.
The defense discovered that there were yet further items belonging to Gertrude Miller, the woman who had survived the strangler's attack and been raped but not murdered. She identified Carlton in court in what was unquestionably the most dramatic single moment of the trial.
That's the man. That's the man. That's the man.
There was night clothing that she had worn to the hospital after her attack. And that clothing had some stains on it. So We find this clothing at some police agency.
And they came back with a DNA result that said he could not have been the perpetrator of the crime with Miss Miller.
So when she had said to the court, he's the man who did this, well, she was mistaken.
This all led us to file what's called an extraordinary motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, which is what's now pending before court in Columbus, Georgia.
The contradictory DNA results, if shown to the original jury, might have created enough reasonable doubt to change the verdict.
Judge Jordan has given us the opportunity to present to him for the first time that no other court's ever heard before, the full nature of all the physical and other evidence that raises questions about Carlton Gary's guilt.
The judge must now decide if the evidence warrants a new trial.
I think we're entitled to a new trial under the law. I think at long last, we would have the trial that he should have had more than 30 years ago. And then we'll have a jury actually decide this case knowing all the facts.
The thing about the legal process, it's imperfect. It's not a search for the truth, ultimately. It's a contest between a prosecutor and a defender. And it's an attempt to test the evidence you have.
Based on the preponderance of the evidence that I heard presented at the trial and my own research, I think they got the right guy.
There has never been a day in my life or in my career since arresting Carlton Gary that I have not believed 110% that he is guilty. Carlton Gary is a monster. He has brought such pain and misery to many, many folks.
I have no reservations about saying he never got a fair trial, not one reservation whatsoever. But all the science tells me he didn't do it. All the circumstances surrounding this case says he didn't do it. There is certainly more than a reasonable doubt about his guilt.
I have absolutely no doubt that Carlton Gary was railroaded. He didn't get a fair trial. What you see in the violations of the law, the violations of the Constitution, is a kind of tip of the iceberg. And my gut feeling now is he didn't do it.